Romans 7, especially talk about a warfare going on in all of our natures that we become aware of at a very early age. Here's the text from Romans 7 to go with the one in Galatians 5. For in my inner being I delight in God's law, but I see another law at work in the members of my body, waging war against the law of my mind and making me a prisoner of the law of sin at work within my members. What a wretched man I am. Who will deliver me from this body of death? Paul sees one thing and desires it, but finds himself doing something else. That's been the common human experience through the centuries. Ovid, the Roman writer around the New Testament period, said, I see the better things and I agree with them, but I do the worst. The Jews tried to explain that. What is there about a person that makes us go in one direction when we really want to go in the other direction? And they decided, the Jewish rabbis did, that God at the creation had put two impulses inside man. They called them the Yetzer HaTov, the good impulse, and the Yetzer Hara, the bad impulse. And their theory was that somewhere between the ages of 9 and 12, the evil impulse is awakened, and man has started following the evil impulse instead of the good. In fact, one rabbi explained Genesis 6:6 in those terms, where God said it repented him that he had made man on the face of the earth. He said God regretted having put the bad leaven in the dough. It's as if God had put both impulses there, hoping man would follow the good, but man wound up following the bad. One explanation. The Greeks had another explanation. Plato, in one of his dialogues, the Phaedrus, pictures the soul riding in a chariot through the heavens, pulled by two steeds. The one steed was good, reason was its name. The other was bad, passion was its name. And as passion looked down and got enthralled with the things of the earth, it served sort of like a retro rocket in modern language to slow the soul's flight down. And so we fell into a human body and found ourselves imprisoned in this prison house of the body. Or as Epictetus put it, a poor, miserable soul shackled to a corpse. The ancient world seemed to be in pretty universal agreement that whatever is wrong with us is the body's doing. The spirit tries hard, but the body pulls against it. Now, when Paul deals with that, he pictures a conflict between the spirit and the flesh. And that conflict is not easy to ferret out. That is, he uses the word sarx, the word for flesh, sometimes in a good sense, sometimes in a bad sense. In Romans 6, verse 6, he says, our old self was crucified with him so that the body of sin might be rendered powerless. Here the flesh is the body of sin. That's the word he uses, flesh. Six verses later, Romans 6:12, he says, therefore do not let sin reign in your mortal bodies so that you might obey its evil desires. The body is sinful, the body's mortal. In 1 Corinthians 9, verse 27, Paul says, I beat my body and make it my slave so that after I preach to others, I myself will not be disqualified for the prize. His body is mortal, it's sinful, and Paul beats it. In Romans 8, however, and verse 23, we begin to get a little different picture. He talks about our adoption as sons, the redemption of our bodies. In Philippians 3:21, he talks about our bodies being changed into the likeness of his glorious body, becoming like Christ. In 1 Corinthians 6, verse 20, he says, honor God in your body. Now, all of that gives such a problem to the translator. That is sarx, is flesh good, or is it bad? That in the New International Version, which I'm holding, the word is translated sinful nature. Now, if sinful nature suggests to you that you inherited a guilt before God, it suggests the wrong thing. But if it suggests to you that there's a bridgehead in your person, an army, when it tries to attack an enemy, looks for a bridgehead, some point of contact, and that through that bridgehead, Satan makes a start with you, then that's what Paul is getting at. The word is used in a good sense in Romans 1, verse 3, when Paul says that Jesus Christ descended from David according to the flesh. It's used in a good sense in 2 Corinthians 12, 7, when he says that he had a thorn in the flesh, his own flesh. Nothing bad, nothing evil about the flesh in either of those references. But in Romans 7, in verse 18, he says, I know that nothing good lives in me, that is, in my flesh. And in Galatians 5:24, he talks of our crucifying the flesh. So the flesh can be good, the flesh can be bad. that leads the translators of the King James, the Revised Standard Version, and Moffat, translating it flesh or fleshly. But the New English Bible and Phillips paraphrase and Weymouth's translation use such things as the lower nature or the carnal attitude to try to bring out the meaning of sarx, flesh. And the New International Version, as I've said, uses sinful nature. What we're being told is that in us, there is a conflict, a war, a higher and a lower desire, and we're all aware of it. But Paul then in Galatians 5 describes the characteristics of the lower desire, the lower nature, and the characteristics of the higher nature. Jeb Stuart Magruder said, somewhere along the way, I lost my moral compass. And don't we all feel that way at one time or another? Today we're going to look at the works of the flesh in Galatians 5, and the next Sunday look at the fruit of the Spirit to contrast them with each other. If you're reading with me in Galatians 5, your list may be slightly different from this list, but we will be able to follow each other. The list begins in the King James Version, for example, with the word adultery. Works of the flesh are manifest, which are these: adultery, fornication. Later on, he mentions envy, murders, drunkenness, and so on. The two words, adultery and murder, are not in the oldest manuscripts we have. They are in some very late manuscripts that was not realized when the King James Version was made. We have a lot more manuscripts available to us now than they did in 1611. So I'll leave adultery and murder aside, but deal with the remainder of the list as in the later translations. The first word, fornication, is rendered in this version sexual immorality. In some of the versions, such as the RSV, it's simply rendered immorality, while in the New English Bible, the King James, and the Revised Version, it's rendered fornication. The word is porneia, which I mentioned to draw out a couple of other words. Porne, prostitute. Pernumi, sounds a little bit like it, to sell. That seems to be the origin of the word, to sell, and eventually to sell love, to sell sex, to sell one's own body to someone else. The thing that's wrong with fornication primarily, the thing that stands back of all the other wrongs that issue from it, is that one person intends to use another person as a thing, and once the passion is gratified, to cast that person aside as a thing. Whereas in true love, two persons value one another as persons made in the image of God and enter into a totally different kind of relationship. The reason some translators have rendered it immorality and the New International Version translators have rendered it sexual immorality is that the word is broader than just the act of fornication itself. It includes other illicit sexual activities, such as homosexuality. It's hard for us to realize the kind of world in which Christians lived in the first century. We think our world is the worst world there has ever been. But in their world, there were temples that were scenes of fornication. That is, priestesses or priests served in the temple to minister to the passions of people who came to worship. There were state brothels operated in Greece, the profits of which went to support the temples of worship to the gods. When the Romans took over, they were more pure at first, but later they became more like the Greeks. Nero, for example, married a young boy named Sporus and had a wedding parade with him through the streets of Rome. It's a widely known fact that Julius Caesar was a lover of King Nicomedes of Bithynia. King Nicomedes was called the queen's rival. Gibbon, who was not a believer in Christ, he disparaged the Christian religion, commented that of the first 15 Roman emperors, only Claudius' love desires were entirely correct. All I'm saying to you is that homosexuality was open, blatant, and widely received. That sexual relationships in general, before marriage or outside marriage, were openly accepted among the Greeks. Demosthenes could write, "We have our mistresses for companionship, our concubines to satisfy bodily desire, and our wives to give us legitimate children and serve as trustworthy guardians." It was quite a world of sexual immorality. So Paul begins his list. The works of the flesh, porneia, sexual immorality. Second, impurity. The older versions say uncleanness. The earliest use of the word was of dirt. We have it in ancient manuscripts, for example, when a person has leased a house or rented it, or when he sells it, turning it over to the other person, he's expected to cleanse it, to get rid of the uncleanness, the impurity. Eventually, the word came to stand for ritual impurity. Some 20 times it's used in the book of Leviticus to indicate that an animal is unclean or a person is unclean and can't come to the presence of God until ceremonially purified. And then eventually it comes to mean moral uncleanness or impurity. And here the word can have two or three implications. One is smutty. Another is repulsive. A person may think he's clever, but he's really repulsive in his language and in his conduct. And still another is just separated from God. Blessed are the pure in heart, they shall see God. Opposite of impurity. Third word is debauchery. This word, translated licentiousness or lasciviousness in the older versions, is the climax of evil. At first, one may do wrong in secret, but by the time debauchery is going on, he doesn't care who knows it. The wrong is done in the most open way. He runs headlong into sin, and the more gratification of the flesh he can have, the better. I always think of Ephesians 4:19 when I see this word, where Paul speaks of some as having lost all sensitivity. They've given themselves over to sensuality so as to indulge in every kind of impurity with a continual lust for more. Now, there's certain roads that are really downhill. And when a person begins to gratify sexual lust, he or she may find self running headlong downhill to greater and greater gratification until spirituality is banished. And that's the warning of the first three words. The second pair of words, idolatry and witchcraft, refer to religious corruption. Modern people cannot understand idolatry. Why would anybody worship an idol or think an idol is a god? Well, the idols certainly weren't pretty. The descriptions we have of Diana of Ephesus, for example, great goddess of love, indicate that she was squatty, breasts all over her body, that she was far from attractive. Why would anyone worship these? The intelligent Greek, the intelligent Roman knew that this image is not God. They thought the image could visualize and localize God. The best illustration I know is the spirit of Rome. When Rome began to conquer the world, she got rid of the pirates from the seas and the robbers from the highways, and people appreciated that. And there were kings who literally willed their countries to Rome upon their death. The spirit of Rome, the peace of Rome, these were great ideas, and people appreciated the spread of Rome. At least many people did. And eventually that spirit of Rome was in the person of the emperor. And the emperor himself would be worshipped. Caesar is Lord. Because the spirit of Rome is embodied in an individual. But Paul's point is that however one does it, in an image, in a person, the created thing becomes the object of worship instead of the creator. And it's idolatry. We may do that with status symbols, with anything that we set our hearts on as first place in our lives. If it isn't God, it's an idol, and that's always a struggle. The next word is witchcraft. It comes from a word, pharmakia. Do you hear the word pharmacy there? Originally, it meant simply drugs and had a good use. Then it came to mean to use drugs to poison other people. And from poisoning other people, controlling them, putting them under the spell, sorcery emerged as the meaning of the word. So that the sorcerer is a person who can compel God or manipulate God to get certain things done or not done. I think it's a severe warning to anybody who takes an astrological chart seriously or seeks a medium, a fortune teller. Those are not things to toy with. Not seriously. Witchcraft. The next series have to do with the sins of the disposition. He's dealt with physical, primarily sexual sins, with religious sins, now disposition. And if you'll notice, through a half dozen words, Paul traces church quarrels from beginning to end. He begins with the word hatred, sometimes translated enmity. Paul only uses it in a couple of other passages, Romans 8:7, where it's the enmity between flesh and spirit. And Ephesians 2:14-22, where it is the enmity between Jew and Gentile. The ancient world had many of the same problems we have. Jew and Gentile couldn't stand each other. The haves and the have-nots couldn't get along with each other. Plato refers to the fact they're at war in almost every city in his own time. Or you have the Greeks and the barbarians. The barbarians were so named because when they talked, the Greeks couldn't understand them. It sounded like they were saying barbar. And the Greeks would say, how can anyone who can only bark ever rule the world? but the barbarians eventually did rule the world. But the class hatreds, and then finally the word is used for hatred or enmity between individuals, man and man, woman and woman. The point being that if between classes, between races, between economic classes, or between individuals, hatred is wrong. Discord, or translated strife, or enmity in other versions. The Greeks sometimes use this word for a clash of minds, and out of the disagreement of minds, some understanding could emerge, but it's never used in a good sense in the New Testament. Four of Paul's six uses of it refer to discord in the church, such as 1 Corinthians 1, 10 through 13, the division at Corinth, or Philippians 1, 15, where preachers are out preaching for envy and strife to tear down Paul's work instead of to build up Christ. The next word is jealousy, and I want to jump a little and pick up the word envy because the two words are connected. The word for jealousy is used in a good sense often in the Bible. The zeal of the Lord will perform this, the Old Testament prophets will say. Or the zeal of thine house hath eaten me up, Psalm 69:9 says, the King James Version. Zealous, the word for zeal. Six of Paul's nine uses of the word are good. But what goes wrong? Combined with envy, we especially see it. Envy is a bad feeling when somebody else succeeds. Jealousy is that warm feeling toward another that can go awry. Zeal, misdirected. Envy is the desire for the other person not to succeed. There's an ancient story about Aristides the Just. A man came to him one day and said, I can't write, but would you sign my ballot and vote for Aristides to be banished? And Aristides said, why? What has Aristides ever done to you? He knew the man was not aware of who he was. And he said, I'm tired of hearing him called Aristides the Just. Well, sometimes the other fellow's good, his success, gets awfully hard on us. Jealousy, envy. Next, fits of rage. It's the word for anger. 300 times it's used in the Old Testament, sometimes good, sometimes bad. And it's also good or bad in the New Testament. You'll remember Ephesians 4:26, where Paul says, be angry, but don't sin. Plato once said that a person couldn't stand for moral principles without some anger. But it's also the word sometimes connected with murder. So it depends on whether anger is controlled. We sometimes say, I just can't control it. I just have this burst of anger, and I can't get hold of it. Paul is saying, you'd better. That's part of what the Christian life is about. He goes on to describe division, selfish ambition. The word here meant working for pay originally, but sometimes a short step from working for pay to working only for pay. Selfish ambition, as if I want the glory that comes from this. Paul uses it some four times, and three of them have to do with competing parties in the church, trying to get ahead of one another. Dissensions is his next word, or divisions, reused only in Romans 16:17, besides here, where divisions and strifes among God's people are being discussed again. It literally means standing apart. All community, all fellowship is broken. Dissension. And finally, his word, hieresis, faction, party, heresy. That's the word we get immediately from it. This word for sect is used sometimes of the Pharisees, sometimes of the Sadducees, even sometimes of the church in the New Testament by its enemies. In Acts 24, Paul says, after the way they call sect, so worship I the God of my fathers. But what he's doing here is saying that quarrels and divisions among God's people are wrong, beginning with hatred and ending with heresy. Then he turns to sins of excess, drunkenness, orgies. This list concludes. Some translations, drunkenness, revelings, and such like. Drunkenness was quite a problem in the ancient world as it is now. Bacchus, god of the grape, was worshipped with a Bacchanalian feast where people got drunk. The Epicureans had said, eat, drink, and be merry, and that came to mean eventually eat and especially drink and be merry. And the Christian has to form his attitude by such texts as Romans 14:21. I'll not eat meat or drink wine or do anything else whereby my brother stumbles. I can't exercise a liberty that might ruin somebody else. And finally, his word orgy or reveling. An interesting use of it in apocryphal literature. In the period between the Old and New Testaments, a man named Antiochus Epiphanes was serving as ruler. The Jews had been conquered, and he actually slaughtered a sow on the burnt altar in front of the temple to show his distaste for Jews and their God. And eventually, the temple was turned into a brothel, if you can imagine. And 2 Maccabees 6 refers to that and calls it revelry. Now, how do we end this? What application is there for our lives? I hope we haven't seen ourselves in too many of these words, but there's a view of the flesh here, and we all struggle with it at one stage or another. There are three or four attitudes we can have. One is to worship the flesh. Whatever the flesh wants, the flesh gets. It's a natural desire, satisfy. Another is to depreciate the flesh. I'm ashamed of that. And that can be harmful to a person's mental health if one becomes so ashamed of every thought one has that might not be exactly what one wants it to be. Another is to think, well, the body's temporary. I'll put up with this as long as I have to, but I'll soon be out of the body, and then everything will be fine. But I believe the Christian attitude is appreciation for the body, a realization that God gave me this body with its desires, but he intended that, with his help, it be controlled. The rabbis thought if you'll just read the Torah, meditate enough on the law, you can control the evil impulse. But Paul learned in his own life he needed grace in order to do that. And you do too. You will fail, but there will be again forgiving grace. The works of the flesh do not lead to a good end. They shall not inherit the kingdom of God, Paul says. We have to try to get away from that. With God's gracious help, we move toward the Spirit. Do you need to make that move today, obeying his will while we stand and sing?